Welcome to Decaf and Debunk, a podcast all about busting myths and bringing light to popular and sometimes confusing topics in nutrition and health, because we all could use a little less caffeine and a little more science. We're your hosts, Hope
and Jessie, and we're super excited to sit down and talk with you today about a topic that is we come across a lot of times in our clinical practice, and we see a lot of misinformation on social media, and we just feel a lot of confusion from the public on, and that is food allergies, food intolerances, and food sensitivities. And so before we dive in to all of that sciencey hot stuff, let's just get a little rundown of how we've been doing.
Yes. So my week has been quite interesting because yesterday on my way to work, I found a stray dog. Well, it wasn't a stray dog. It was somebody's pet. And because it looked so well cared for, I thought I'll just run it by the vet, make sure it doesn't have a microchip and get it back to the person. Well, it didn't have a microchip. So I brought a dog to work yesterday and Jessie helped me babysit it because my boss was coming to observe my teaching in my class. And so bringing a stray dog to class probably was not an option in that situation.
It's been good. We had quite the day yesterday with the dog at work. That was definitely an adventure. And that comes up because we were supposed to record this podcast yesterday and Hope got home and she was just like, I can't do it. Can't do it. Can't do it.
Yeah. I didn't find the owner and get the dog home until almost 6:30 PM. And I was like, I haven't eaten dinner. We'll do it tomorrow night. So
that's he had a solid 10-hour adventure. So that was fun.
Yes.
And if you don't know Hope, she has three dogs of her own already. And she has been so adamantly trying to convince her husband to allow her to get a fourth.
And when I FaceTimed him with the dog in my car, he was like, do not bring that dog home. And so
yeah, just Hope FaceTimed me yesterday morning and I was literally walking out the door for work and she FaceTimed me and she has a dog in the back of her car and my husband's over here, like, look, sees that over my shoulders. I'm getting ready to walk out the door. And after I hung up with her, he was like, she would find a dog. She would find a dog.
He was very friendly, very well behaved, a good pick me up for a Monday.
Yeah.
For the most part.
The students liked him. Like, he was super, super great in class. But yeah, it's been, if you cannot tell, our lives have been a little bit hectic. We just got, you know, back from spring break and my husband and I went to Ireland. And so that was fun. But it's just like a whirlwind to come back. And then you just have so much stuff you have to just like get on top of and handle. Mm-hmm. So feeling like I'm finally getting my footing underneath me. It's full steam ahead to the end of the semester now.
Yeah, spring break always is almost like a double-edged sword because you're like, okay, I get a little rest. And then you're like, there's this many weeks left.
Yeah.
Not that we're not excited. We love our students. We love our classes. But it is, there's so many. For the people that are on the student side, there are a lot of assignments and you feel it, but we grade it all too. So we feel it on the other side as well. Like I currently have, as I'm recording this, like 20 exams to grade that are all open-ended questions. So I'm, you know, successfully procrastinating.
Yeah, we're doing a great job. So that's just a little sneak peek into our lives that have been as of late. And probably an explanation as to why we don't record more podcasts. So we're just on a once every other week right now. Maybe if we hit the summertime, we'll record more. But let's dive into this week's content. So Hope, you have some advanced training in this area with regards to more of like pediatric allergies. And so I'm going to let you kind of take the lead on this. And I'm not as well versed in pediatric allergies, so I may ask some questions as we go along.
Yeah. So I work with babies most of the time, but I also work with families, kids. And I was seeing so much and getting so many questions about, well, is my baby have a food sensitivity? Could it be something in my milk that's making them sensitive? And then when solids came in, are we supposed to introduce allergens early? Are we supposed to wait? And I didn't have all the answers, so I did some training with the Food Allergy Research and Education Institution on pediatric food allergies, because I was like, I have no idea. And that was a one-year course. It was so, so, so good. If you're a healthcare provider and you work with this population, I would highly recommend the course. It was led by fantastic instructors, I guess. But yeah, and so that was why I really looked at getting more training, because I felt like people were asking me questions and then you're reading the research on it and it's almost like, well, I don't know. You need almost someone who's specialized in that research area to explain to you what the research is saying, similar to how for general nutrition, we would do that for the general population.
Yeah. So I have a little bit of expertise in this area, but not formal training per se, but I do see this a lot when I work with individuals about like, why is this food not digesting well for me? And so then we have to get into what's the difference between a food allergy, a food intolerance, and a food sensitivity. And so a lot of times I'll have people say like, I think I'm allergic to this food. I just don't feel good when I eat it. And I have to kind of back up and say, okay, probably not allergic, because usually allergy is going to manifest as more of like a hive-like response, like, you know, something that's going to like feel more, show itself a little more externally. Whereas if someone's dealing with something like an intolerance or a sensitivity, a lot of the times we feel that more internally, and that might be a delayed reaction. A lot of times it's GI in nature. So a lot of people feel just maybe bubble gut, maybe excess gas, bloat, diarrhea, different things like that. And then some people even kind of manifest with, maybe I eat this food and I know for a fact that every time I eat this food, I get a breakout. Or I know for a fact that every time I eat this food, I get like just really weird feeling and like I just feel off. And so we have to kind of then navigate like, what is this? And like from a practical standpoint, how do we address it? When we're looking at how to define some of these things, a food, most of the things that I see in the GI world are not allergies, because a lot of the times you know when you have an allergy and you have to do something about it. A lot of the times it's an intolerance or a sensitivity. Usually an intolerance means we just lack the enzymes to help, or enough of the enzymes to help break down some of those foods. And so when it passes through our GI tract, other things like bacteria that exist in our gut have a heyday with it, and produce a lot of excess gas and stuff, or it pulls water into the intestine and we have diarrhea, different things like that. Whereas a sensitivity is not as well of a defined term. We just see that as like, this food just doesn't make me feel quite great. And so I definitely see that a lot of times with gut stuff.
And it actually, that description of what you see in GI really is a huge distinguishing factor when we think about that there's actually two etiologies. An etiology is the what's actually happening in your body with some type of metabolic health, what's the dominoes that are set off. And we have two etiologies of allergies. One is like you were describing, the systemic response where you're like, I can't breathe, or I have hives, or my eyes are swollen, my mouth is swollen. That is like a standard, or what we think about when we think about an IgE mediated allergy. Then the harder one to deal with, which is what I see in my population a lot, is the non-IgE mediated allergies, because there's all of these inflammatory responses, but they're not necessarily systemic in nature, where it's influencing lots of organ systems. Mm-hmm. So in my area, we tend to be trying to distinguish between, with a kid, is this an IgE food allergy, like you were saying, or is this an intolerance sensitivity? And actually in the pediatric population, a lot of children will outgrow a non-IgE mediated allergy by the time they're two or three. Not every kid. There's some diagnoses that are for life. So it shows up a little differently in pediatrics and as we're introducing solids, but the same thing, area of confusion is similar to your population, where it's like, well, there's these ambiguous symptoms that potentially are even benign, but beyond that, you don't feel comfortable when you're having the symptom.
Mm-hmm.
And with kids, babies, and adults, some of that is a conversation about how severe is the response and how uncomfortable does it make you? And how much did you love the food? Is it, this is special occasion, right? So we see a lot of that in my population as well.
Yeah, those are conversations that I absolutely have all the time with people, especially when it comes to something that a lot of us are quote unquote intolerant to some degree, and that's lactose. A lot mm-hmm. of adults, we lose some of our ability to digest lactose as we get older. And basically what happens is anytime we eat anything that contains lactose, if we can't break it down, again, it passes through our GI tract. We're supposed to absorb things in the small intestine. We don't have the enzyme to do that or enough of it. And so it passes to the large intestine. Our bacteria enjoy it. It Woo-hoo! Pulls some water into our GI tract. So a lot of times we have gas, bloat, and diarrhea from that.
Mm-hmm.
But I end up having a lot of conversations with people of like, I mean, I like as an individual that has a little bit of lactose intolerance. I really love ice cream and it's probably my favorite dessert. And I'm just going to be willing to have a little bit of the GI side effects from that, knowing that it's not like a systemic issue and it's right. not causing like inflammation in my entire body right. to eat a little bit of lactose. It's just a digestive right. response. And I'm willing to be a little bit uncomfortable for a little period
Until
of time.
It passes.
And so,
yeah,
you have to help people work through some of that sometimes.
That's also really funny because a fun fact about, I know a little bit too much about anything with milk because it's what I have researched, but a fun fact about the lactase enzyme is that you can actually, because of the way we evolved and babies need milk, if you continue to consume dairy products in any amount, your body can actually generally continue to produce that enzyme. But if you stop consuming dairy for like an extended period of time,
mm-hmm.
your body can actually shut off the enzyme and then it's possible it won't turn back on.
Yeah. It's definitely like a, you, if you don't use it, you lose it kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And we see that a lot of times. I see that like anecdotally, the research is not super, like it's not really explored a lot in this area, but like a lot of times people would like cut out gluten from their diets because they thought it was really like bad for them. When in reality, like it's maybe not be the gluten that's causing a lot of the digestive responses. It's the other thing that's in wheat that are FODMAPs. And we kind of talked about that last time. But a lot of times when people cut that out for extended period of time, when you add that back in, you have like a period of discomfort where your gut tries to figure out like, oh, I've not seen this food
What's
in a while.
Going
I gotta
on?
Figure out how to break this down. And mm-hmm. anecdotally, I see that like, and it's kind of like, all right, well, we have to work through this hump if we want to continue to eat it.
Yeah.
Kind of thing.
It's the same. And that's where the difference between a true allergy or a sensitivity intolerance kind of comes in, because it's kind of similar to if you're someone that doesn't eat a lot of greasy food or fried food, or even if you don't eat a ton of fiber, and then mm-hmm. all of a sudden you throw a ton of that into your diet in a day because you're on vacation or because or for whatever reason, maybe you just had an extra couple of salads that I don't know,
mm-hmm.
your GI tract might like, whoa, hang on a second. This is not our norm. The bacteria that you have in your and Jesse, you can probably speak more to this, but the bacteria that you have in your microbiome are going to be preferential to what your typical diet is. So when there's a yeah. shift, there's going to be some changing, mm-hmm. you know, of the probably the amount of certain types of bacteria, whether or not they can digest the things that are there and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, your bacteria, like your gut's like an ecosystem. So if you are feeding these microbes a very specific diet and all of a sudden you change things up, like they might not be able to break down some of the same food that you're now introducing. And so it may take a little bit to shift, and that may cause a little extra digestive discomfort for a period of time. So yeah, we definitely see this across the lifespan in a whole bunch of different areas. But
yeah.
I think one area that's like really interesting and I don't know a lot about is like lactating individuals. So you work a lot with lactating individuals. And I saw it some when I was doing it, like my dietetic internship and rotations, worked in a GI clinic and did some of that. But I would see these mothers come in with their babies having reactions, and the mom would then be kind of advised to look at their diet. So do you want to share a little bit about like what you see with that and like the passing of like different allergens or like intolerances or things through kind of the breast milk?
So it's really interesting because this is an area where Jesse and I actually, our areas of interest end up overlapping a ton. And you'll hear why as I go through this. But really, the interesting part is actually starts happening during pregnancy. When you are pregnant, you have one of the hormones that's released is called relaxin, which does what it sounds like. It makes your muscles and your tendons relax. But where that can actually also impact is your gut. So the tight junctions between the cells in the postpartum individual can be looser. So what we can see is that full intact proteins that they eat in their diet could potentially, not for everybody, show up in their breast milk. So for example, in dairy products, our main allergen is beta-lactoglobulin. We will literally be able to detect beta-lactoglobulin still in its whole form in the milk after a parent consumed it in their diet.
Yeah.
And this is going to be large because in someone who has a healthy GI tract, you know, they're not postpartum or having other things that cause a more what we call a leaky gut, you're not typically going to see full proteins move through. Those would be broken down, digested, absorbed. So what we end up seeing is that parents have to go on what we call an elimination diet to try to figure out what's the trigger. And symptoms, again, can be a little bit ambiguous. Also, they can be very benign in the infant. But then there's some on the other end of the spectrum where, like, for example, one of the more severe ones is if we can visually see blood in the stool, just like a full grown adult who's having GI discomfort and, you know, subsequent inflammation, all that stuff. So, yeah, I love, well, I enjoy or I get fulfillment out of supporting these people. I don't love that they have to be eliminating things, but because I feel like it's so hard to, for these individuals to think like something they're doing is potentially hurting their baby. And that's where really being able to educate on how much of this is really a health concern for the baby versus maybe same as the adult, the conversation we were having earlier, is this a little discomfort until it passes? And it's not the end of the world if we had an accidental exposure through our milk versus we actually have some case studies that are published of babies having FPIES reactions, which is a more severe allergy that causes vomiting and dehydration through breast milk. So it is possible for the baby to have a true allergic react, like an IgE mediated or a more severe, like an FPIES.
Is there a way that you can test for this, like, or is it more of just like symptomatic diagnosis?
Yeah, it's symptomatic. What pediatricians generally are using is blood in the stool, but unfortunately they also do what we call an occult blood test, which is putting the stool under the microscope. And in one study that I read, when they were just doing a random sampling of healthy and not healthy, like and triggered babies, a third of all babies had occult blood in the stool or microscopic blood in the stool. And some of those were healthy, otherwise healthy. And it's like, so then you start to think about what are the diagnostic criteria for these things? And honestly, the gold standard still, and this is, I think, true, you can confirm for your population, but is re-exposure. Like it should be, it should happen the same way. If you have an allergy, when you are re-exposed, you will have a reaction again. Versus if you are intolerant or you have a sensitivity, maybe it depends on what kind of ice cream you grab. Like, is it full gelato or, you know, from... I think it's similar though in the GI realm of figuring out, is this an allergy? Is this an intolerance?
Yeah, usually what I see, like I said, if it's presenting as an allergy, like we know it's pretty immediate and it's happening and we're very aware of it. And the only, like, an allergist will tell you, like, the true gold standard of diagnosing an allergy is like demonstration of an allergic response. Yes. Yeah. And you should do that you should do that in a very controlled setting, mm-hmm. with EpiPens and stuff around. Mm-hmm. So not something to self-test at home. You do it with an allergist. But yeah, they will tell you, like, that's like, we do have tests that we can run and different things that you can do, but like the gold standard is like demonstration of an allergic response in response mm-hmm. to eating a specific food. If we're talking mm-hmm. about like a food allergy. One thing that I see every now and then, and you could enlighten me more on it with your expertise in allergy, is like an oral allergy response. And I do see that kind of carry over sometimes into manifestation of some GI irritation with mm-hmm. some clients.
And that's actually really interesting because there is an allergic disorder that is oral food pollen syndrome. Mm. And this, I would think, would also extend throughout the GI tract because during a season where, for example, in the South right now, we're in pollen season, everything's yellow, mm-hmm. that irritates the individual enough so that certain foods, if they eat them during that time period, they'll have a response because everything's already activated. But other times of the year, maybe not. But again, similar with the food allergies is allergist after allergist, even in this course, the gold standard is we'll try it again. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times there are a couple dietitians, I don't think it's as common yet, but I think it will probably become more common, whose entire specialty is within an allergy clinic, helping with what we call an oral food challenge, meaning mm-hmm. I'm going to feed this to your child. We're going to watch and see what happens. And they're also doing some really interesting things with exposure therapy and mm-hmm. figuring out with a ladder, is there a threshold that maybe you won't have a reaction so that we can make some safety recommendations.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So one thing I feel like we get a lot of questions on, and I know you get a lot of questions on, is especially working with like pregnant and lactating individuals and infants, is like, is there anything that the pregnant individual or lactating individual is doing that's causing these like responses in an infant? Mm-mm. Like more specifically, like, is there anything that they do in pregnancy that could predispose an infant for developing an allergy?
Yeah, there was one systematic review that looked at increased fruit and vegetable intake during pregnancy. Mm-hmm. But honestly, the research is most strongly linked to a genetic component. Like if there is a strong family history of allergies, then that's something we watch for. And then there's also a tie-in with autoimmune conditions in general. So if you have a baby that has sensitive skin and has been diagnosed with eczema, they are more likely to develop a food allergy, you know, in the long term. Mm-hmm. But it's the most research that we have is that it's not anything really that anyone can control, and it's not anything that anyone did wrong.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So in terms of like outgrowing an allergy, how often do infants, like the majority, kind of like you said, do tend to outgrow it? Yeah.
So it depends on the allergic reaction, but allergic proctocolitis is what we see most frequently, which is an inflammation that's happening from exposure to a protein that came through the milk. And generally we see this as GI discomfort, similar to like an adult, if they were uncomfortable, it's like the baby seems gassy, they seem fussy. You know, we're seeing parents doing a lot of bicycles or like trying to soothe to get them to sleep. That condition, 95% outgrow by the time they're one. And they don't have a subsequent food allergy to dairy.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. One thing that I think I would like to touch on a little bit, because I know I get it as a question a lot, kind of hinted at it before, but are there tests? So we just talked about like the gold standard of what you can do to test for an allergy. Like, there are different tests you can do, like I said, but the gold standard is that exposure. There are a lot of tests on the market offering the services to diagnose intolerances and sensitivities.
Yeah. So do you want to share first a little bit about what's in your which tests are marketed in your population?
Yeah. The ones that I see most often are IgG, food sensitivity tests. Usually they're just marketed as blood-based food sensitivity tests. They're like the direct to consumer test where you can get it at home. And you can do like, sometimes it's like just like finger prick stuff. Sometimes it's like, go get a blood draw and then submit this test. And basically,
is it ever saliva?
I think there are saliva based ones. Most of the ones I'm aware of are blood based.
Okay.
So most of the ones that I've seen on the market are blood based. So to give you an example, say an individual comes to me, they're having all of these GI symptoms, they can't figure it out. And if I was, I'm speaking from like a person that's going to act, this is not how I would act. I'm like, go take this food sensitivity test and then come back to me. So if you're working with this individual that has all of these GI issues, they go take this food sensitivity test, they come back to you, they have this long list of foods that they are quote unquote sensitive to. Well, the nature of these tests, they're IgG based, which is a different antibody than IgE that mediates most allergies that we typically mm-hmm. associate as allergies. IgG is a memory antibody. And so basically what it tells us is that we've seen this food at some point. Our body is like, I've seen this. I've been exposed to this at some point. It's no indication. And it's not correlated with a lower tolerance to that food. There's actually some research that shows it might be correlated to a greater tolerance.
I was literally going to say that. I actually, in my course, had multiple allergists reiterate that there are people that will have higher IgG antibodies because they ate more of that food recently. So yeah. they don't use that in an allergist's office. They do not mm-hmm. use that as a diagnostic test.
Nope.
In any capacity, like they yeah. just don't, wouldn't have you spend the money on it.
Yeah. And there's definitely people that there's a mix of people that are professionals that are probably using these tests irresponsibly, or just like not paying attention to the science. But then there's some that are really kind of capitalizing on the fact that if you are an individual with GI concerns and you eat a ton of these specific foods and you get this test done, it comes back with a panel of foods. Most often, because of the nature of IgG test, the foods that you eat most often, like Hope just said, are going to come back as the foods that you're quote unquote most sensitive to. And mm-hmm. as a patient, that can feel incredibly validating because you're like, holy crap. I've mm-hmm. been eating all of these foods that are on my like do not eat list, like in the red category. Oh my gosh, I'm so sensitive. No wonder why I've been feeling like crap. And in reality, that test is just telling them, hey, these are the things you're exposed to most often. And then mm-hmm. we get into the dangerous territory of the same kind of stuff that we talked about before, like fad diets. You're in that tricky slope of now you're being told to cut out all of these foods that may or may not react with you. Sometimes you'll find one that's like, maybe I eat it all the time. It pops up on my IgG. Maybe I really don't digest it very well.
Yeah.
But most of the time, it's going to be foods that you're going to be cutting out for no reason other than a test mm-hmm. told you to, and it's not validated. And then you go down the rabbit hole of like, what if you were already like a pretty healthy eater and all right. the foods now, you're now limited and you're like, well, I can't eat any of these healthy foods like that
right.
fit into my lifestyle that I enjoy. Like that becomes really tricky to navigate with food that can kind of kick you down the slope towards disordered eating habits and spiral from there. It's really scary.
Yeah. And I was going to say a similar response with the positive intention can happen with individuals that are feeding their babies and their babies having the reaction mm-hmm. because it's all good intention that people are generally telling them to cut dairy out. The next most common is soy. The next most common after that is gluten. But imagine you can't eat dairy, you can't eat soy, you can't eat gluten. And now you're like, and a lot of the providers that I have worked with families after because they were really struggling to find things to eat, they never put the food back in to see if, mm-hmm. and the parents are saying, well, there wasn't really that much of a difference in the symptoms. Okay. Eat the gluten, eat the dairy, whatever it is. And I have a really great example. I had one client that I was working with recently who, when I met them, they were already dairy and soy free. And they honestly gave very mixed review. They were like, maybe, but he also, like, the child also had COVID recently. And they were like, I don't know if this is because of recovering or because it's actually helping. But they, at that point in time, were like, I'm good, like, staying with the dairy and soy, and I really would like to figure out what the trigger is. Mm-hmm. And it was so very quickly that it went from just dairy and soy. And my first recommendation was actually to challenge those foods because they were so mm-hmm. unsure about if they made a difference. But throughout this whole process, it literally ended up just being eggs if they were scrambled, like not cooked all, like, you know, when you can make an egg and it's like more yeah. runny. Yeah. It only was egg if it was cooked in, like, less than all the way done. Yeah. That was the only thing that the baby was really responding, like having a reaction to. And yeah. then when they got to solids, no allergy to egg for whatever reason. And maybe their system was better by at that point at breaking down whatever protein it was sensitive to.
Yeah. And so what you just said a minute ago brought up something for me, and then I lost it because my brain is, I was going to say something because oh, it.
Well, I wonder if it was related to this, because the main point of that story was that the restrictions, people are thinking like, well, maybe it did help me. Then they end up on these restrictions long term and they mm-hmm. never try to put anything back into like re, and that increases the risk for nutrient deficiencies. So yeah. ideally, as a dietitian, we just want your diet to be able to be as liberal as medically necessary.
Yeah.
So that was the one, whole point of the story.
The one thing that it did bring up for me is that dealing with some of these like intolerances and sensitivities from a GI perspective is very difficult for the fact that our gut is so tightly connected to our brain. And so when mm-hmm. we start to, so say that individual that was getting that food sensitivity test came back, they have this list of foods that they now think they're sensitive to, like, because the test told me this, well, now I'm going to feel a little anxious every time I eat those foods, mm-hmm. even if you tell me to rechallenge them. And we know that our gut is so tightly connected to our brain. Like, okay, well, I'm entering this meal very anxious about what I'm eating. That in and of itself can cause us to have maybe some not so great yeah. GI responses. And so then you have the added layer of like, when you start going to like fish for foods that are causing you issues, and you start to overcomplicate it and think about it so deep, like deeply, you can actually cause some of those responses by being yeah. so worried about it.
Yeah, it's psychosomatic.
Yeah, and which is why it's really important to have a dietitian or a trained professional like on your team, because mm-hmm. I mean, we can't remove like your feeling with that, but we can sit down and help you rationalize like, were we entering this meal really anxious and different things like that to try mm-hmm. to help identify like what's going on from a psychological perspective.
Yeah, luckily with the exposure through milk, we remove one of those layers, because even if the parent is overly anxious, usually, I'm not going to say always because we actually don't have enough research to just say always or never, but usually, even if the parent is super anxious, we can tell if there's a difference in the baby or
yeah.
not yeah. Relatively quickly. So, but that
you can't
is,
pass necessarily that is, the anxiety through the breast milk. That yeah. we know of.
And then that we know of. But then I also, this actually brought up a question for me, for you, which is, so if we had a situation where, okay, I think that I have this intolerance and, you know, have the appropriate support and we're working with a dietitian, we're like, okay, we're going to intentionally remove this just to see how I feel. Does the period of time make a difference for how much the microbiome changes? And if the reintroduction if the removal allowed for enough of the shift in the microbiome is it possible that reintroducing caused upset because of the shift? Does that question make sense? But that's just kind of like my thought.
It does make sense. So there is a little bit, we don't really know for sure how much is tied into the microbiome, but we do have, for some of the elimination diets that are evidence-based, it's a very structured removal and introduction phase that takes some time. So you remove it for a good period of time and you introduce it for a good period of time. And so that hopefully gets around of any of those like digestive shifts that might occur from like a standpoint like that. To kind of tangent onto the microbiome is really when we make short-term dietary changes, what I like to say is short-term dietary changes result in short-term changes to your microbiome. So usually our core microbiome is able to kind of really can just kind of stay there in the background. And these short-term changes may change populations to a small extent, but the bulk of our microbiome stays mostly the same. And when we go back to eating what we were before, it usually reverts back really pretty quickly. And so I get less concerned about the microbiome changes, but we do have more of a structured phase of like, yeah, you're not going to just introduce this food one time and be like, I had a reaction this one time. It's a no-go for me. We're going to try it a few more times and try to be a little bit more persistent with it to see if we're really having a reaction or if we're just having a little bit of that initial digestive discomfort. Because again, there's a little bit of that, if you don't use it, you lose it kind of thing that can happen. And it may not be enzymatic in nature, like you're losing your digestive enzymes all the time, but it could be related to the microbiome. It could just be related to your body's like physical ability to break down some of those foods if they're like different shapes or bulky or fibrous or things like that.
And the same thing, we apply the same thing with infants and kids, obviously, because we generally will have someone reintroduce, and because there's always the small chance or the small like likelihood that it was chance that this overlapped. Like I've worked with some people and they're like, well, I did reintroduce the soy and then my child got, you know, a respiratory something, they have a stuffy nose. Do you think it's related? And I'm like, we honestly, you have to give it time and see if they're feeling uncomfortable and want to pull it back out. Of course, you know, supporting them from a perspective of making sure they feel confident picking foods. But usually same with infants is like, well, let's just see, because maybe they're just getting some adjustment. Maybe it was just a random night. Like sometimes they'll log in and be like, well, I introduced it and then my baby didn't sleep last night. And I'm like, yeah, but how often, like, would you say on average per week that your baby doesn't sleep well? And they're like, okay, fair. We'll give it a couple days, because like, okay, could that have just been a bad night just because? So that's really interesting.
Yeah, I see that a lot. And I have to work through that with a lot of patients and clients a lot, just because of, we're really quick to make these snap judgments. And this gets back to something you and I probably deal with a lot. We're really quick to blame food for a lot of things that maybe food has no involvement in. You know, had a client before that we're reintroducing some foods and we have a little bit of that anxiety when we're reintroducing foods. They're dealing with a lot of stuff going on at work and their digestive response in terms of IBS is to lean more towards constipation, and we're introducing these foods and they're like, I was more constipated. And so then my brain goes, okay, well, maybe it's not the food. Let's take a step back. What was our movement like? Were we drinking enough water? And so it then comes out of like, oh, I was really stressed that week. I sat at my desk a lot. I didn't move a lot. I didn't drink enough water. Like, maybe it was that. And it's like, we're so quick to blame food a lot of the times, when a lot of the times it's not really the food for a lot of people.
Yeah. And that makes me think, one of our colleagues says this very eloquently, so I'm probably going to butcher it, but that the emotional toll of thinking about if you should or shouldn't consume the food can sometimes be more harmful than just eating the food. That's probably not the most eloquent way that I know she says it way better, but that is so true, because when you're that stressed, we know that there's all of the hormones that get released when you're stressed, like cortisol, for example, directly interact with our hunger and fullness hormones, with our adipocytes, with our, you know, all of our metabolic, they all interact. They upregulate, downregulate, and that is going to influence your physiological hunger, your physiological fullness, your ability to even sense physiological hunger and fullness, et cetera. So I think that's a really good point, especially when we think about sensitivities that an individual says, well, you know, sometimes if I go out for sushi and I eat too much of the garlic that's, you know, comes with it, or excuse me, the ginger that comes with it, then I have this symptom. Okay, well, how often do you actually go out for sushi and consume that much of the ginger? It's not going to be like a life or death situation.
Yeah. Foods, sensitivities, allergies, intolerances, it can get really messy. But I think one of the biggest take homes here is, like, one, you probably know if you're having an allergy, an allergic response. Number two, if your infant is having an allergic response or needs to be seen, you probably have some evidence of that too. Work with a provider in that case, work with an allergist, work with an immunologist, work with a lactation consultant, work with a dietitian, work with a team that's trained in that, in that area, to help navigate that. If you're having sensitivities or you're not digesting food well, think about some of the other things in your life that are kind of maybe impacting it, impacting your food environment as well. Different things too, like movement, water intake, all of those things. Don't immediately jump to blaming food, but stay reasonably curious about, like, every time I eat this food, I don't really feel that great, because that could be very true for you. And if you're having issues navigating that, it can be really helpful to work one-on-one with a dietitian to kind of help you look at it with an objective lens and not have so much of that influence of your own brain kind of muddying the waters. And so I think that's a really good place to
I was going to say, our listeners are going to think, like, these people are broken records, because I think we came to the exact same conclusion last time, was get some movement, drink a little bit more water, make sure you're sleeping enough, make sure you're stressed.
For the most part, the biggest things that are going to impact most people's health the most are some of the simplest in theory to implement, but from a behavioral standpoint, they can be very difficult to just consistently implement and have that consistent behavior change, because there is a lot of psychology that goes into making sustainable behavior changes. And good thing dietitians are trained in helping you do that. So it's another plug to work one-on-one with a dietitian. But do want to validate, like, people do have true intolerances and true sensitivities. Currently, we don't have treatments for those aside from removing the amount of food or the food entirely, or just kind of making sure we can power through it and support our GI health and responses from a different lens if we want to go have that ice cream and deal with some of the outcomes later. I think you'll hear on this podcast a lot that the bulk of the stuff that's going to be most beneficial for people are going to be the simplest. But a lot of times you just need a little bit of the support to get there. And that's why that's why we're here. And that's why we are happy to help you find a dietitian in your area. Like,
And if you are a general person dealing with this, you can go to grovenutritioncollective.com and our root system and our seedlings. Allergies is one of the topic areas that's in our space. So there are resources about how to feed your children, about how to eliminate different foods or think about them from a more critical lens. If you are a professional, I have a new course coming out that if you're a lactation professional, more specifically, or a pediatric professional, that looks at the interplay between immunology and the immune system and the infant. And Jesse makes a lovely guest appearance on there talking about the infant microbiome. So we have support for both sets of populations, and we'd love to connect you if you have more questions.
Yeah, we would love to see you over there. Yeah, the root system and the seedlings in our Grove Nutrition Collective have a lot of resources. So start off in the free version of the seedlings, see if it's going to be your jive, and upgrade to root system where you can have a little more access, and then direct contact with us one-on-one where we can have some Q&A and answer some of your questions more directly and maybe help you find the resources that you need if you need to connect with a more formal doctor or dietitian. Yeah. But yeah.
So until next time, we invite you to stay responsibly caffeinated and reasonably skeptical of nutrition and health claims you see online.